Coming up, it's Media Matters with Marie Buskey and Marty Gibson, discussing the media through the RCR lens, right here on Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio. You are with Marie, and joining me now for Media Matters, as he does every Thursday now. How's life in Papadopoulos?
Oh, it's fantastic. Spring, sun shining, chickens are clucking, kids are fighting, school holidays still. But life's good.
No, it is very, very good. We're going to kick things off. I'm going to dive straight in. There's a pun for you. The Manawanui sinking off the southern coast of Samoa. Oh, man, the memes have started already. I've seen them from overseas. Of course, a $100 million vessel hit the reef in southern Samoa. 75 crew have been rescued. Commander Yvonne Gray has copped a lot of flack on this. And I have to admit, I find the assumption that this has happened because she's a diversity hire a little grating for me personally. But unfortunately, when you live in this cultural space, that is the first thing that people are going to jump to, aren't they?
There is a perception that people get hired because of their sex, race, or sexual preference. Then it does cast an aspersion even on people who are deservedly in a position. Mm. And you know, that's led to some of these cruel jokes about women's difficulty with parking and things like, just terrible jokes like that.
I'm waiting for the inquiry. I think that's the most sensible thing. I think she's copping a lot of flack that is quite unfair. I mean, she is a naval officer with decades of experience, both with the British Navy before she came across to New Zealand. I've spoken to somebody that has served under her and said that she was an exceptional commander. So, and this person was a 23-year Navy veteran. So they were not just
a lady.
It was a woman, but I've spoken to both her and her husband, and both of them were Navy. I have to admit, it's a cheap shot, and it makes for a funny meme, but part of me is kind of like, come on, guys. I think we're a little bit better than this, aren't we?
Do you know what astonished me even more than the fact that, you know, the ship had caught fire and been sunk was that we paid five times more than the book value of that boat in the first place?
I know, that was a dear leader decision, I hear.
Yeah, what an odd thing to do. It's a bit like when Cullen bought Kiwi Rail, or what was to become Kiwi Rail. Infratil just couldn't believe their luck. They still celebrate the day that they did the deal, because a deal like that only comes along once in a career. Mm. So, yeah.
When you actually look at the sorry state of our Navy, and again, I've heard via back channels that they've really been struggling to get ships to sea because of lack of personnel. Now, we only had five ships to begin with. So the Manawanui was the latest into the fleet. And as you said, over in the odds paid for, you know, are very overpriced. This is the concern, I think, that Kiwis don't necessarily understand. You know, the Navy are responsible for helping protect our maritime borders. They're there for natural disasters, part of our security at sea. We've got the ninth longest coastline in the world and one of the smallest navies in the world. Every other partner in the Pacific Basin is in the top 20. We don't even feature.
Well, it's huge, our economic zone as well, our exclusive economic zone by virtue of how big the New Zealand continent is. Yeah, it's one of those things we should spend more money on, but we're spending money on other things. So
this is the difficulty, isn't it? We have to have a Navy. We've got a tiny Navy that's struggling. Now it's lost, what, $100 million vessel, which isn't insured, which is quite normal, but that's another 100 mil that if the government were to replace it, that it needs to find, and that's assuming it's going to replace it. And that even goes before the cost of the cleanup comes in with the Samoans. I've seen the theme in the paper, need to have versus nice to have. It is so difficult now. How does this government figure out what are the needs to have and what are the nice to have? Because at this stage, we've been talking about our student politicians with their credit cards that they've been maxing out on lots of nice to haves. And have Kiwis gotten a little bit lazy and expectant on the things that they like to have, the nice to have, and actually have forgotten and lost focus on the needs to have?
Yeah, I mean, if you sheet this back to the media, there's a lot of column inches in that pantomime between Labour and National, isn't there, in classifying each other as big meanies or reckless Marxists. You know, we've all got our team that we cheer for, and that's the entertainment factor of news in many ways. And It's really encouraging seeing these movements through Chris Bishop that we're starting to come to terms with the fact that we need consensus on which infrastructure projects we need to have. I've talked on many occasions about the zipper consensus, where, you know, we should start at the bottom and work out our common values. And this, it comes back to that thing that lets kids be kids stresses very heavily. We're teaching kids that their identity comes from something that's at the very top of the identity pyramid, your gender, your sex, and your race, whereas we really need to establish their identity at the very base of it, which is our shared humanity. If we had those basics right, we could be a lot more realistic about how much discretionary money we've got to spend on various indulgences, like the tens of billions that we're going to be spending as indulgences to the climate fairies. That never gets the discussion. In fact, discussion of that is actively suppressed. And it's something like, if we take the figure of 70 billion, which, as our listeners know, I'm fond of working with, it's still around 30 times the total treaty settlements, or maybe, you know, subsequently it's come back to 20 times. But if you think about how we've torn ourselves to pieces talking about treaty settlements, the comparative paucity of discussion on the, well, I'd say the folly of thinking you can borrow your way out of the consequences of climate change, such as they are, of anthropogenic CO2, it seems kind of odd.
I do like the fact that Chris Bishop has been looking at a number of projects, particularly in the infrastructure space, as you said. And one of those things, reports now to come out, has been the school property report. And so that has been looking at a number of education projects and how those get prioritised, and those that have actually sort of jumped the queue because they've got sick of waiting and they've gone to the media and placed more pressure on the ministry to get that work brought forward. But again, I wonder, with education and knowing the politics of many involved in education, also had the same malady that we've seen in the likes of Dunedin Hospital. You start planning under a government who is spanking the credit card, and you plan accordingly, and then all of a sudden, grumpy old granddad who's cutting off the trust fund is coming in and saying, well, actually, no, this is not good enough. We need to pare this back. We need to live within our means and create infrastructure within our means without all of these bells and whistles. And honestly, the hue and cry that's going up from many in the sector, when actually that's how we used to do infrastructure all the time. The greatest infrastructure boom in this country after the Second World War was all things. I mean, let's face it, you and I were educated in good old prefabs back in the day at Lytton and Gisborne Gills High School. I mean, that's how we used to roll.
My cynicism's probably showing through here, but I'm looking for a problem reaction solution scenario here. You don't have to be a financial whiz to look at the accumulation of debt and how unpayable it is, and understand that we're heading for a crisis and the lack of will within the media, who should be overseeing this sort of thing. And politically, where, you know, Labour come in and do all the spanking, and National really aren't that much better in terms of borrowing since 2006. I actually picked up a really good Matthew Hooton column, which I'd missed, and I didn't talk about it the other week. He was sheeting home how governments were pretty financially responsible up until about 2006, and then they just started absolutely taking off. Bill English and John Key were as bad as Labour, and the latest government is starting to at least confront some issues around housing and the fact that house prices probably need to come back, which Bill English says in an article was untenable during his tenure. The solution is going to be the CBDC. And I've heard a commentator say that. They're going to get things so bad that there's going to be a suggestion of, oh, well, maybe a universal basic income will allow these families that currently can't eat to at least have security. And that's only fair. You know, we've got to feed people. So here you go, CBDC, universal basic income, off you go. Yeah, we'll just need to have that digital ID to oversee it all. Mm. So I think that's, if you want to know where this is coming from, you can look further into suggestions about capital gains taxes. It's like, well, the tax base is getting shorter, smaller and smaller, so we have to take some of this capital. By we, It's not like the younger people who are burdened with looking after these older people are getting that money. It's going to pay the interest on the loans that we've taken out for our climate change indulgences that the media has just cheered along. So, yeah, I think we really need to have a good look at this. I think RCR and Alistair Harding are doing God's work in putting together that series, not only on the CBDCs but on fluoride. Really, thank you, Foundation members. It's your contribution that allows some of these things to be given the attention that they really need, because our future's at stake.
Mm. Because in terms of the universal basic income, I mean, that is something, I mean, essentially it's just welfare in another name. And when has that ever fixed anything? One of the little interesting things that I've noticed, actually, you were saying that, was anything that looks like a public-private partnership seems to get spanked. And then anything that is fully public needs to sort of be funded. And I think the reality of it is we're in a space now where it is inevitable that we need to enter in public-private partnerships. Now, whether that be in the form of, say, tax relief that Casey Costello is absolutely getting hauled through the coals now for the heated tobacco products, or a building within prefabrication and building and actually subcontracting out, which they've started to do to get more affordable housing into the market and open that up. I don't know, but having the government try and build and deliver anything, as Chris Burp is discovering, is not the most efficient way of getting what it is that you want to the market. It's just not going to happen.
His point was well made, that it's sexy to talk about these bespoke school buildings you're going to open, and politicians love doing that. It's not as sexy to go around the country saying, you know, we're going to cork your windows where they're leaking, or we're going to do maintenance. No politician wants to be cutting the ribbon on a tube of cork.
No. No, and that's the difficulty. I mean, one of the projects that they cited that a lot of this arose around was going to join together Marlborough Boys and Girls Colleges, and they had a look at it in 2011, 2013. The cost began as $25 million, but by 2022, it had ballooned out to $400 million without robust analysis linking costs to measurable benefits. While the ministry decided to pause the co-location project in December 23, the extended planning and design for the new facilities has been an expensive mistake, with up to $25 million sunk into costs so far. I mean, this is light rail. How many millions, how many tens of millions have been blown on pontificating?
The more interesting question for me is always, how many billions of dollars have been made on pontificating? Because then you've got the incentives for pontification.
There's a consultant out there consultants who have made a lot of money.
Who probably started their career in a government agency paid to achieve things, and then moved into a consultancy and was paid to complicate them.
Mm. In the same edition as that article was, of course, Stephen Joyce with his bi-monthly piece, Why New Zealand Battles with New Roads. And of course, as well as being finance minister, he was the Minister of Transport. He was the Simeon Brown of his day. As he said, there has been an outbreak of bipartisanship lately on some of the big issues facing our country. Well, talk of it at least. Again, lots of talk, very little action. Lack of bipartisanship is also a problem, though, particularly with long-dated issues that transcend the government, such as with the provision of infrastructure or the qualification age for superannuation. Overdoing the contest of ideas in these policy areas can lead to constant flip-flopping and nothing gets done.
Yeah, well, Labor's actually made that a strategy subsequent to the last election, which I think is highly cynical and dangerous. They're saying, hey, whatever you do, we're going to overturn it. You're going to reinstate oil and gas? Don't worry. Don't bother about coming down here to look for gas companies. We're just going to squash it, you know, long before you commercialise it. It's economic vandalism. I mean, this is, again, where lack of numeracy is really hitting us hard. And there was an excellent article in the Weekend Herald, We Won't Have Any Business Left. Did you read that? It's, what went wrong in the electricity market and why it will get worse. You've got to read between the lines a little bit, but what went wrong was fossil fuels bad, thermogenic generation bad, but they just simply didn't understand that in order for a so-called sustainable power generation to work, you've got to be able to manage peak demands or low wind, low water, and you've got to do that with gas and coal. You know, one of Jacinda Ardern's most underquoted phrases that I thought absolutely summed her up was, in my mind, it's simple. I think in her mind, it was simple. Fossil fuels are bad. Gibson is Mercury Energy General Manager Phil Gibson said the reason that there's been a higher forward price curve is a lack of certainty around the reliability of assets in the market, mainly the lack of reliable gas and thermal generation. Gibson said part of the solution to the crisis would be the country accepting that gas is a good thing for decarbonisation, not a bad thing. You need it to make the green energy work. It's not a reductive thing where you can take it out and have the system carry on. Yeah, there's gas in the ground, there's stuff to be extracted, but for some reason we've failed on all fields in the last 6 years. That's kind of a mistake. For some reason, in my mind, it's simple. You can make up your own mind about whether that is attributable to politics or not, but we need to sort it out. That's some great yes minister stuff, isn't it? But I can possibly comment.
And some of the numbers in that article were actually eye-watering, because what I hadn't realised was the dynamic that these large companies, so we're talking the Winston Pulp and Paper, the Methanex-sized companies, they buy their power in advance and speculate on what the price of that power is going to be. And most of them budget between $70 to $90 a megawatt. And then, of course, the price has started to tick up to around $200 per megawatt, and they were starting to get a little bit scratchy. So it said things began to change in September 2018, where prices began to slow, seemingly an inexorable rise. Within a year, they cracked $100 per megawatt. By 2021, they had $130, and earlier this year, they hit $208 per megawatt, with some future prices settling even higher. Many large and well-heeled industrial businesses could probably sustain a spike in peak prices like those in August, but when the wholesale peak price hits $800 per megawatt, when they cannot sustain a year upon year of these prices, the electricity futures market suggests that that is precisely what they're in for, a future of exceedingly high electricity costs. This is the new normal for these large businesses.
He's talking about contributions to increasing electricity demand being large televisions, computer equipment, and electric cars. And so the spiking power price is killing our ability to make things that we're exporting, because we are not generating enough power to run the things we're importing. So again, it's not good for the economy.
No.
And you've got to confront that there is a large section of useful idiocy in New Zealand that thinks the price of power should go up. We should use less energy. But again, in my mind, it's simple. They're doing it on feels rather than an actual confrontation with the reality of how much energy people in developed economy use and the effect on people of cutting the availability of energy suddenly and without a plan to really offset some of those problems.
This, again, as we've said before, is ideology rubbing up against real world reality and
smashing into it.
And when you're looking at the cost of 230 jobs with the two Winstone pulp mills, the Penrose mill for OG5 Solutions, another 75 jobs, Methanex haven't reported how many jobs they're going to lose there. These employers are touchstone employers, particularly those that are in those smaller towns. This is massive. That the knock-on effect, and again, you touched on it before, what concerns me is that the solution that the government will provide to these key employers in these provincial towns is, don't worry, nanny state is here. We've got a universal basic income for you. We will take care of you. That's my worry.
Yeah, problem, reaction, solution. It's coming. And I mean, there was an interview, and I'm just mentioning this now, and I didn't plan on mentioning in advance, so I don't have the guy's name. The guy who'd applied for a job with the Reserve Bank as the central, the CBDC implementation guy, just to see what was up with it. And that's what he was saying. It'll be introduced next year around September. With a universal basic income, by that stage, they would have tanked the economy so badly that people will welcome it with open arms because it'll seem compassionate and fair.
Oh, now hold on. I can't put my finger on it. What is it? I'm sure that was done in the 20th century. What was it called again? Yeah, exactly. Be careful what you wish for is what I have to say there. Another thing that we highlighted, I brought it up just before we got started, like the whole beat up on Casey Costello, that's actually really annoying me because they're really beating up on her, particularly around these heated tobacco products. And I've just been struggling to understand why, other than the fact that they're looking at this number and they're trying to conflate that, oh yes, the 217 million, that might be
silly. Yeah, maybe if the sector grew enormously,
massively,
it could grow to 200 and something million dollars. And so,
and they're conflating that with
the
money.
About four or six from memory.
Yeah, that the government are not giving to the Dunedin Hospital project. But I still couldn't get my head around it because I'm thinking, well, hold on a second here. She's not stupid. Casey didn't come down in the last shower. They're hitting her hard, both in the opposition and the media, because they know she's come from Hobson's Choice. They know that she's come from a very practical, pragmatic place, and they don't like it. And she's been dropping truth bombs for quite some time.
They hate class traitors, don't they? They're especially waspish of women who don't toe the party socialist line.
No. So she has looked into this as an alternative for people to get people, the smoking rates down. We've got incredibly low smoking rates in the Western world anyway. She's still wanting to get those smoking rates down. She's looking at these heated tobacco products. I didn't even know they were a thing because I'm a lifelong non-smoker, so I don't understand these things. But as a way to transition people from the ciggies onto these heated tobacco products as a smoking cessation. I'm sitting there thinking, well, they're no different to the patch. So
I don't get what's different between vaping and heated tobacco, unless it's a way of heating the tobacco to the point where, rather than having the actual nicotine comes off the tobacco, rather than being purified into a vape system. I'm not sure. Again, I haven't done the necessary research to sound informed on it, but I know that most of the harm in smoking comes from the tars. That's where most of the carcinogens come from. And again, the government's messaging could be better. You could say, hey, look, there are people right now who are smoking and suffering a wide variety of health problems from it. Your concern is that more people are going to get into smoking through this. Our immediate concern is giving these people a healthier option to sustain their addiction, and it's going to result in better health outcomes for them, especially people who are chronically ill with a whole lot of very expensive conditions that are costing our health system a lot of money. If we allow their immune systems to recover because they're not under all this pressure from the carcinogens and the tar and cigarettes, it's going to be better for everyone.
Richard Preble actually summed it up really well yesterday, and he looked at it and he was talking about 90-day targets. He said these governments are too focused too much on these big inspirational targets, Jacinda, I'm going to cure child poverty, all of these big aspirational things that are meaningless, the weasel words, they just, wah. Whereas 90-day targets, he said, at least gives you something to work on. And he used this case in point that they're beating up on Costello. She's looking at this as a potential option. You put it out there, you test it, you measure it. If it works, perfect. You're actually working towards your smoke-free or your smoke reduction targets by a certain period of time. So hello, ticking a box. If it doesn't work, well, then you take it away and you try something else. That's how you figure out how stuff happens. Doing nothing is a decision. And I think the problem that they're having is the fact that this tax break is going to big tobacco, whereas when you look at all the other smoking drug-related smoking cessation products, well, that's big pharma. So they don't get all the extra tariffs and stuff on gum and patches. So, why are you sort of getting all exercised over these heated tobaccos? But it's a distraction, and I think it's something they can use to beat up the current government on, and they're running with it.
Mm. I think there was some government, I can't remember, it was an Eastern European one, did a study once that smoking had a net benefit to government. And it does. That was the dirty secret for years. is that people who die of heart attacks a year after they retire, they don't need dementia care, they don't need hip replacements, they might incur some health costs before they die, but the reality, they don't need pensions, they don't need to be kept in retirement homes. It saved the government money in quite a neat way.
Yeah. Anywho, hey, speaking of, I think Kāinga Ora is back in the papers as well. Firstly, one of the board members got a knickers in a knot over the report released by Bill English. The other thing that the Kāinga Ora was in the paper over was the fact that they've played the fun police and they've stopped a whole bunch of people living in one of the housing developments. They have a combined common room getting together and they've mixed happy hour between and six. I mean, really.
Planting trees on Housing New Zealand houses. That's always struck me as very odd. They want control, I guess, and ultimately it's civil servants not wanting to have to deal with bad news, and everything they do, they have to look at it in terms of, well, what headlines could this generate? And that obviously is a fair drag on what they do as well. I was trying to get through the Otago professors that we're talking about, Philippa Howden Chapman.
That's the one.
Complaining bitterly about the report. She did not accept the validity of your blanket criticism of this Crown agency, which has provided an extraordinary number of quality, warm, dry homes since its inception. Regrettably, the final Renew report does not acknowledge in any way the board's careful and respectful responses to the initial report, does not correct any of the fundamental factual errors identified, and does not replace the anecdotal evidence with more robust evidence. That was true. I could imagine why it would peeve her.
I just sort of wondered about that, though, whether or not she was prioritising the nice-to-haves over the needs-to-have. She's not wrong when she says they've delivered quality, warm homes into the marketplace. But I also know that they could have delivered a lot more homes into the marketplace, but the quality and the specifications on those homes, they're incredibly high-spec homes. For purpose. So they're beyond purpose, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And if you haven't got a home, there's that failure to understand that people get better. So, you know, when you're homeless, you'd rather have any kind of home. It doesn't mean you're going to stay there forever, and ideally you don't. I mean, I thought Claire Trevitt's, and we touched on this before, her column, Can Bishop Fix It? The Politics of Pulling the Pin. I thought it was a pretty good article about that. The trouble successive governments have found is that actually building things is a lot harder than saying you will build them. Mm. That's the epitaph of the last Labor government, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Some of the problems that Christopher Luxon's having with the confidence of the business sector, he got low marks for his political skills. However, he got marked highly for keeping his cabinet focused on delivery and also got kudos for coalition management skills. And I think that there's an aspect of government that's good in some ways, but when it grows, it becomes bad. And that is that the policy determines the outcome. So it's kind of this fire and forget things, this autopilot that you don't have in business. When you're in business, you're always sensitive to what's working, what your customers are liking, what they're not liking. You stay more nimble because you're not judged on whether you're following policy. You're judged on whether you're achieving the desired outcome. Yeah, they've got to sort of find a way of selling that so it's not like, oh, you're just sort of interested in money, or you're just, you know, wanting to privatise everything so your rich mates can get richer.
And the difficulty too is that it feels as vote catching. Needs isn't vote catching. Nice is vote catching. And the difficulty that they've got is how do they get all of these projects off the ground and actually realistically get some stuff achieved and done and not spend money on planning and do what the previous government fell into the trap of doing and actually get some runs on the board in a timely enough manner to actually get to stay and to do another term to continue to do it again. Because as you said before, the previous government or and the coalition of those parties, I mean, they talk about this unlikely coalition between National, New Zealand First and ACT. In reality, I find the coalition between Labour, the Greens and Te Pāti Māori, you've got sort of two very shaggy tails wagging a very insipid dog. If that's your alternative, look at what will get rolled back, even more wastage of money, you know, the whole sort of airy-fairy ideological basis of this is where things are at. You've got a Labour Party that's still having an identity crisis. It doesn't quite know where it's at. Stephen Joyce talked about that in his, actually. He did a direct comparison between the Australian Labour mechanism and, I think it was Stephen Joyce, one of them, the Australian Labour mechanism and what they do in New Zealand. And here, as you said, they will just, if they don't like something, they just roll it back. They're like, oh no, you know, if you put oil and gas back in, we will just turn around and ban it again. By saying that, no more investment happens. You know, companies, they need more than a 3-year electoral window in order to invest and make significant changes and infrastructure in a country.
Well, you know, we'll get back to the name of our show, Media Matters. This is what a healthy media should be doing. It should step out of time. It should reflect the views and aspirations of New Zealanders, and I guess push in some ways for government action on the basis of sound research and numbers. But the customers of the media are not New Zealanders. The customers are advertisers, and the advertisers have got a vested interest in things being a certain way. And so that's what gets pushed. Did you read the review article on Shane Jones?
I did.
I thought that was good. Every time I find myself thinking that Shane Jones is New Zealand's best politician, I have to shake myself. It's quite a turnaround from when I was quite cross at him. It's quite funny. One of the reasons possibly is Jones acknowledges he is playing jester less than he did the last time he was in government. Jones acknowledges the shift after getting a message from leader Winston Peters about a year ago. There was a sense from Winston that he didn't really want a 65-year-old larrikin, Jones tells the Herald. This time around, he was pretty upfront with me. But it's working. I think it suits him, and I think his subtlety doesn't always sit well with him. It evaporated entirely on Lambton Quay on Monday. On his way for a haircut, he crossed the street to talk to a group of climate protesters objecting to his bill overturning the 2018 ban on new oil and gas exploration. They were not in the mood for a debate. He was harangued by Valerie Morse via a close-range megaphone as a climate terrorist. Another called him off being an effing sellout. And Valerie Morse, wasn't she one of the terrorists in Uruwera? Wasn't she?
Oh, I don't know, but wouldn't surprise.
That's another point they could have made. Yeah, I thought it was an interesting insight into him. He is widely recognised as being among the creme de la creme of native speakers. Jones led the government speeches at King Tuhitia's Tangi last month and at Waitangi in February, in which he recited the elaborate whakapapa links to distinguished visitors to Ngāpuhi. And if you read his childhood, he was very much raised on the marae. So he's the real deal in a lot of ways. It was good to get that insight into Shane Jones.
Well, also too with Shane Jones, and I've always been fond of Shane. I was fond of Shane when he was with the Labour Party. I've liked him because he's always had the ability to reach out and talk to everyday New Zealanders at their level. Across a wide spectrum, both provincially and from an urban aspect. And the only probably group now that he struggles to connect with are these group of urban elite, you know, these Lululemon laptop lifestylers, which I am always so disparaging about. But they're the likes of the Yvonne Morses on megaphones who, you know, spend all their time protesting and doing these things. He's probably lost connection with them, but for the vast swathe of New Zealanders, I think they get Shane. And I think Shane has the ability to talk to people on both sides of the political aisle because he's been.
Yeah, well, it was interesting his take on the treaty, wasn't it? I'm highly distressed by the way in which the whole debate around the treaty, the whole debate around Māori identity has got out of kilter. I don't like the idea that the treaty has been dismembered and now it has become fashionable to only conceive of the treaty as te tiriti. And if you are Māori, you do not subscribe to a conception of the treaty beyond te tiriti. If you refuse to see the treaty in any other way but te tiriti, then you are wasting your Māori blood, or you're a traitor to your Māori blood. She's, of course, talking to Mapi Clark's rather tempestuous outbursts. Jones has referred to the Waitangi Tribunal as a star chamber and totalitarian, for which he was rebuked by Attorney General Judith Collins and Peters. It's a point about well made, and I could have actually then given some clarity of what the star chamber actually is. In English law, it was a court made up of judges and privy councillors that grew out of the medieval King's Council as a supplement to the regular justice of the common law court. So it's a very apt description. When, however, it was used by Charles I to enforce unpopular and ecclesiastical policies, it became a symbol of oppression to the parliamentary and Puritan opponents of Charles and Archbishop William Laud. It was therefore abolished by the Long Parliament of 1641. So it's a very erudite and clever comparison, very appropriate. So that's another thing that I like about Shane Jones, is his refusal to dumb it down. In doing so, offering something of a guiding star for Māori, that there is a way out of thinking everything bad that happens to you is someone else's fault and being perpetually in grievance mode, which is, hey, you know, we're capable people. Let's go. Let's do it. And I think most New Zealanders can really get along with that. And probably there's a responsibility we have to, well, as you know, I talk about the lovers and the haters. It's not black versus white. It's the lovers versus the haters. We lovers have got to get it together, man. We've got to say, okay, well, let's ignore government. How can we help kids and work together? You still be you, I'll be me, but, you know, let's get some stuff done. And I see Jones, if he carries on and does take leadership of New Zealand First, he could do some great things in that space.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. Speaking of other leaders of the minor parties, David Seymour had his debate last night with Helmut Modlick over the treaty's principle bill. I didn't watch the debate. I've only just read the article around that, which was in the Herald. It's great that the debate actually happened. Up until now, you haven't had people wanting to even discuss this. I mean, it's not even been out there. So good old Seymour for fronting up, and Helmut as well. Now, he is the chief executive of the Te Runga o Toa Rangatira. And so he was able to talk to, I think he's quite involved in Ngā Tamatoa. It was a debate that they discussed quite openly. So Modlick said the only reason democracy exists as we know it today is because of the terms within the Treaty of Waitangi. It's a historical fact that every non-Māori person, every democratic or civil institution in this land is only here because of the sovereign tribes of Aotearoa and the British Empire reached agreement on terms of their existence here in 1840. The opportunity for that democracy to be here in the very first instance is because of the terms of agreement reached between the chiefs and the representatives of the Queen's government that we're here. That's the only reason democracy was here. His sort of point is that it was a partnership because of the whole concept of mana, and that something being mana diminishing is something that they would never have agreed to, whereas of course Seymour is a bit back and saying, well, Queen Victoria, arguably the most powerful superpower at the time, would enter into a partnership with 100,000 Māori on the other side of the world. So you've got lots of sort of lost in translation, and Seymour did quite often go back to the principles, because as he said, as we've talked about before, those treaty principles, they've only been around for the last 40 or 50 or so years. So they are a modern construction.
Yeah, and one of the groups that fighting against it are Toi Tohu Te Tiriti, which means leave the treaty undisturbed. And again, it's Luciferian doublespeak, because the treaty principles, you could argue, have disturbed the treaty, particularly the idea that we'll all live under a common law and be free to be ourselves and own our own property under that.
It's probably not going to go any further. I mean, both, New Zealand First want to go further. They want to get rid of the Waitangi Tribunal and really go to town. However, Luxon has said he won't support it beyond the first reading. But I think for Seymour, he's got a long-term game on this.
Government considered de-establishing Māori Crown Relations Office, and I think the kernel of an idea in that was that the government wanted to unwind grievance from aspiration, the past from the future. The cabinet paper said, we propose the distinction should be between an agency dedicated to settling past grievances and an agency tasked with looking to the future, ensuring iwi, hapu and whānau Māori thrive. So, you know, and there is, you often hear in among those protesters, I walk backwards into the future, looking back, and it's kind of like, hey, how's that working out for you?
Mm.
So, yeah, there's a very definite divide between the two. I don't know how we're going for time, but I'll tell you something like that really just jumped out at me in the paper was a whole lot of stories on weather, no mention of climate change. And I sort of saw the first one and I was quite surprised because I kind of, here we go, wasn't there. And that one was fears exceptional rainfall in region may threaten lives. No mention of climate change. It was just ripe for it by Benjamin Plummer. And then another one, property owners, this is on the facing page 2 of Friday's Herald. Property owners cry out for help. Struggle to get financial aid for homes damaged by storm because of grey area. No mention of climate change. There was another article in the Weekend Herald. Dunedin faces post-flood fix after deluge hits region. It was a stuff article about the hurricane that's currently beating on the Carolinas, and it didn't mention climate change.
That's incredible because I've been following both, obviously, Helene, which is the one in the Carolinas, and then Milton, which is about to hit, and probably it's hitting actually as we speak right now. And the American media, legacy media, all over climate change, like to the point that I heard caught a piece with one meteorologist sort of literally weeping when he's doing his report, talking about how climate change has warmed the oceans so much, which has just made the storm so powerful, you know. And it's just like, wow, really? Pull yourself together, son. Far out.
I haven't looked at chemtrails as deeply as I could. I haven't really sort of beyond seeing the odd clip. But I know for sure there is the HAARP program. And I know for sure that part of that is beaming high energy, microwave energy into the upper atmosphere. And I know that if I put something metallic into a microwave, it arcs. And I know that what they say is, or aluminium foil, I know that what most people who are doing chemtrail research say is being sprayed is aluminium. So, and, you know, you can see with the Carolinas, you can see flight paths of various US military planes zigzagging around just before the storm intensifies. So, you know, I think there are a lot of people, as I've said before, who say, oh, I don't believe in chemtrails. I don't believe in that. They don't mean, I've looked at it, it's unlikely none of that ties up with actual. They don't mean that. They mean, I'm terrified that there could be this going on and it's not being talked about by Paddy Gow.
Well, but look, the storm, the first storm, Helene, that's hit last week, it hit in an area that the Carolinas usually does not get affected by these storms. These big storms hit the coastal areas. So they hit Florida, they hit coastal Carolinas, they hit Georgia. And by the time they start dissipating inland, they have sort of just broken down to essentially bad weather. This didn't happen this time. The sucker went straight across and it was still
changed
raging.
Course in a quite sort of odd way.
Yeah, and it's been devastating.
There's all sorts of funny stories. And there was an article in where it's gone in the flurry of chucking paper around, but it was talking about how dumb people were if they said that They speculated that FEMA was not helping Americans because they spent all their money on illegal immigrants. But there's a pretty good paper trail to suggest that they've spent all their money on illegal immigrants. And also, there are some very odd stories coming out about FEMA blocking American citizens trying to provide aid to people, that they've made it very onerous.
So Elon Musk talked about that in the last couple of days.
And
he was saying how he'd organised helicopters and he was going to get Starlinks into these remote areas so they could get connectivity back up and running so they can get connections up to the outside world and communications. And they went to go and bring the helicopters in there and FEMA said, no, can't bring the helicopters in. You need to tell us exactly who you're delivering these to. And he's like, well, we don't know who we're delivering them to. No. We just know people don't have connectivity. And in the end, he had to go directly to the head of communications and transport, which was Pete Buttigieg. Yeah, and went to Pete Buttigieg and said, hey, come on. I'm delivering these. These are on me. Okay, I'm going to drop these into the Carolinas. These people need to get a connection. And we know Musk does this. He did this in Tonga after the volcanoes. He's big on this. And he said, credit where credit's due. Buttigieg was like, oh, yeah, we need to make this happen. But, not everybody are the Elon Musks of this world. We saw exactly the same thing here in Cyclone Gabrielle, where people in the Esk Valley weren't rescued, helped by those in civil defence and on the ground. It was the locals that got in there and did it. And many of them actually had to go in and around past police saying, we're going in there in boats and we're going to get people out. That whole veil of safetyism, and I guess in the American context, safetyism plus lawfare, has actually stolen away human courage and actually stopped people doing the right thing.
Well, and, hanging over that, you've got the spectre of governments not wanting people to live in remote rural areas, wanting to clear out the countryside, put people in 15-minute cities. You can even catch people saying that in places. I try not to get down about the idea that there's a jackboot stepping on a human face forever, but it's frustrating when you can pick out some of the talking points of some of these dystopian thinkers and they're being translated into things to get useful idiots to go, yeah, that's what we want.
The census, I had a quick little glance at the census. There's been lots of talk about New Zealand's increased diversity. So in other words, less Europeans and more other people. There were a couple of little things that I plucked out of the census. And one was around Te Reo speakers. There's 4.3% in New Zealand now that speak Te Reo. Interestingly enough, there are a lot more people that speak either an Indian language or Chinese language than there are Te Reo, just saying.
How many people do you reckon say they speak Te Reo and can't speak it for?
Well, who knows? But 4.3% is what they claim. This is the number, and I know you go, I'm going to preempt your eye roll now because I know what's going to happen. This was the number. This is right at the very, very bottom. Because for the first time ever in the census, they asked questions in regards to your identity and not your racial identity, but your sexual orientation or what have you identity. The 2023 census also recorded that 172,383 people, or 4.9% of adults, belong to the LGBTQI+ communities. For the first time, a New Zealand census recorded data on gender and the intersex population. In short, 50.3% identified as female, 49.3% identified as male, and 0.4%, well, they were confused and didn't know what they were. That's me paraphrasing there. Anywho, that's a total of 20,400 people confused, by the way. There are 26,097 people who identify as transgender, or just 0.7% of those over 15. That minority does not explain the disproportionate amount of attention the community attracts from some quarters, but like other forms of prejudice too, it will pass. And this is in regards to, this is the post editorial, which I know you don't get. I found that quite amazing. This does not explain the disproportionate amount of attention the community attracts from some quarters. I was just like, oh my gosh, stop the presses. Really? You're going to say that? That 0.7% has been, that's a very the supporters of that community, very loud, very powerful. Look at what, I mean, just look at the toilet issue for starters. We are literally bending over backwards, spending millions, if not billions of dollars. The PPTA are changing guidelines in terms of what they have in their education policy, the Midwifery Council, all of the stuff over to accommodate and appease 26,097 people, the feelings of those people, perceived feelings of those people. That's what we're talking here.
You know, again, it's what we're arguing about when we're not arguing about what we really should be arguing about. And that's probably why it gets so many column inches. You know, those things, those issues, racism, transgenderism, really took off in America anyway. Just if you look at the incidence of those words in the press, it took off when the left started to occupy Wall Street and the right started the Tea Party, started honing in on big corporatist interests tied with big government interests, which is fascism. They didn't like that.
Mm.
And so whenever I'm caught in one of these arguments about that sort of thing, I do try and get my mind back to what I really should be thinking about as soon as possible.
Right.
I see something else with the lack of reporting on the weather. There was one article about the weather that had climate change in it, and that was rising heat putting New Zealand children at risk of lifelong health problems. This was done by, in a major new study, researchers drew on data from nearly 650,000 children to link daily high temperatures with increased hospitalizations around New Zealand. They found that children under 5 were at significantly higher risk of needing hospital care when temperatures hit 24.1 degrees centigrade. As long as it's 24, you're right. What's that 0.1 of a degree centigrade? This is where science reporters who don't know dick about science are a problem. You really should have a plus or minus there to let you know how sensitive the measurement is. Maori, Pacific, and Asian children disproportionately in danger. Those lifelong health problems from climate change range from infectious diseases to blood and immune disorders to issues with kidneys and skin. Could it be the temperature, or could it be something else? Modeling predicted that the number of admissions would continue to climb as the planet warmed, with clear implications for healthcare, housing, and urban design. So getting back to those 15-minute cities. The findings come just days after NIWA scientists published new modeling showing a sizable jump in the number of 25 degree centigrade plus days this century. Good old NIWA, right? And I had a look at this study, and it comes out of the Human Rights Commission, and its approved budget is $1.199999.10. That's its budget. The researcher is, the chief researcher is Dr. Hakan Lai. He's not a doctor of medicine. He's a doctor in community health. And so I'm reading this. Yeah, focus is very much on the burden of disease potentially attributable to heat exposure in children in recent and future decades under climate change temperature increase scenarios.
And potentially attributable.
Yeah.
Not actually attributable, potentially attributable.
You know, you've got money that you can get if you research climate change that holds that it's a big problem. So, yeah, I thought that was quite an interesting contrast to the sudden disappearance of climate from weather stories. And I wonder whether it's because, hey, we're on the hook for it now, and it's really going to start biting that we're having to pay all this money to the climate fairies as indulgences for our climate sins. Maybe they're just, it's a bit like now they stop talking about COVID. The image that always comes into my mind is when a snake bites something and then goes away while the poison works.
Mm. Hey, just quickly before we go, we haven't covered it, but the big hole, the deficit, Lester Levy, man, he's got such a job on his plate. And I just saw this quote, again, this is from the Post, but I know this story popped up and across all the papers, Health New Zealand saving target, now $2 billion. They lead with the headline that they're having to actually find more money to save. What they should have led with on that headline was how much money was actually in a deficit that they'd already lost. They should have saved in the previous quarters. However, Cabinet approved $419.5 million for Health New Zealand in September outside of the reporting period from April to June. Chief Executive Margie Arpa said the 2023 deficit also was also due. So they had a deficit of actually... the quarterly report shed a clearest light so far on how and why Te Whatu Ora finances deteriorated from a forecast surplus of almost $300 million to an unaudited deficit of $934 million, so nearly $1 billion, by June 30, 2024. Margie Arpa said the 2023-24 deficit also was due to one-off factors including write-offs of surplus, COVID-19 stock, $193 million. Read that as PPE and vaccines, people. $193 million. Don't hear those protesters squawking about that in Dunedin, just saying. Holiday Act payments, $172 million, and cuts to Hauora Māori funding, higher than expected staffing costs and more outsourcing. Holiday Act payments. Now, what that is that there, and I'm pretty certain of this, is there's been a group action going on because the payroll system miscalculated holiday pay to health workers when it was shifted several years ago. And there's been a group action going on to get back paid unpaid holiday pay for nurses and doctors for quite some time on that. And so that was, yeah, so they've obviously finally settled that at $172 million. And then, yeah, Hauora funding higher than expected staffing costs and more outsourcing. So that says to me they've had to cut stuff down, there have been golden handshake payments, and then they've had to set up the outsourcing as well. So more money. And again, you don't hear the protesters jumping up and down about that in Dunedin. I mean, that's more than. I mean, that's, you know, that's nearly $350 odd million. You don't hear them squealing about that. No, they squeal about heated tobacco products instead.
Yeah, it's that sort of take care of the pennies and the pounds will take care of themselves idea.
Yeah.
You know, if we worry about Christopher Luxon making $70,000 selling his apartment, then I guess before we go, Dane Tupou wrote a column mourning the loss of his sister.
Very touching column, yes.
Very touching column, and he wrote, "For those who read my columns, you know that I normally write about politics. Politics is only a small part of my life, my whānau at the very centre of my being. It's the same for us, Shane, and their consolations on the loss of your sister. Sorry to read that."
Yeah, yeah, very, very touching column and very sad for Shane and all his family. We're going to head off. We haven't got enough time to feedback today, but actually don't panic. We'll do some more next time. 2057, if you've got something you need to let us know. I did forward you something actually that Mike from Foxton sent us directly. So yes, Mike, we did grab that and I did pass that on. And of course, inbox at realitycheck.radio is the email. All right. Okay, my friend, we will head off and I will talk to you again next week. We'll do it all again. And who have you got on Fourth Estate tomorrow?
No, there's no Fourth Estate tomorrow. The producer's on holiday, and the idea was we'd do it maybe sometimes every second week. It's a little bit loosey-goosey, but we'll be back the week after. But you can, I think, they need to play a replay.
Enjoy your Friday with the school holidays then, eh?
Yeah, we'll do. Thanks again, Marie, and look forward to catching up again next week.
Perfect. We'll talk to you then. And don't disappear, everybody. Breakfast, if you missed it this morning, it's coming up again on our replay here with Reality Check Radio. Take care.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.